Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the Congress of Berlin of 1878 and its significance and meaning and importance in terms of understanding the diplomacy in Europe towards the end of the 19th century, and really what the contribution of the Congress of Berlin has, not towards the stability of Europe, as is commonly believed, but towards a greater destabilisation. Okay, so the Congress of Berlin is a meeting of the great powers called in 1878 for a month between June and July by Bismarck, Germany's Chancellor, who is concerned really that events in the Balkans are about to escalate beyond his ability to contain, and that Germany will be dragged into a general European war, or that even if Germany isn't, that a general European war will be extremely bad for business, and that Germany will suffer economically as a result, even if she's on the sidelines. Okay, so a process is unravelling in the Balkans throughout the 19th century, and the process has really begun in the 18th century. That was really the decline of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire that in the 17th century had reached almost the gates of Vienna had progressively declined, and the hold that the Ottomans have over the Balkans particularly is challenged repeatedly throughout the 19th century. The inability of the port, the Sultan's government in Turkey to meaningfully reform and face this the challenge of modernity that is emanating from the dual revolutions in Europe, the political and social revolution of the French Revolution and the economic industrial revolution from Britain, these challenges are not really being met by the Ottoman Empire. And whilst there's a period of reforms in the mid-19th century called the Tanzimat, the real fact of the matter is that these are sort of insufficient and don't go far enough, and then can be challenged by the Islamic religious establishment within the Ottoman Empire. So the problem that the Ottomans have becomes a wider European problem, because the decline in the Ottoman Empire leaves a vacuum within the Balkans, and two rival powers, the Austrian Empire, or after 1867, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Russian Empire, both have designs on influence in the Balkans. Let's talk about Russia first. So, throughout the 19th century, a culture of a pan-Slavist culture had developed within Russia. Pan-Slavism really was the idea that all Slavic peoples were to be united under the same rulership, or under a kind of a federation, a commonwealth of Slavs. The northern Slavic peoples, the Russians and Russians, Ukrainians, Belarusians, Poles, and the southern Slavs are the people of the Balkans, Serbs and Bulgarians and Montenegrins. the and Bosnians. The Balkans are an area of particular interest to the Tsars of Russia because this is where the majority of Orthodox peoples live outside the Russian Empire. And the Tsar's position as defender of the Orthodox faith meant that he was defender of the Orthodox faith anywhere in the world. This meant that a Tsar who could not defend the Orthodox faith did not have as comprehensive a public approval as perhaps he might like. From 1861 onwards, we see in Russia the beginning of what you might call a revolutionary era, which finally ends, I would argue, in 1928 with the cementing of power of Joseph Stalin. That revolutionary period begins with the failed sort of half-hearted emancipation of Russia's serfs, who were emancipated into immense poverty. If you go way back to the start of these podcasts, there's a whole bunch of stuff on Russian peasants. And this really means that the Tsar and his autocratic government have increased difficulties throughout the period, and there is a temptation to look to overseas glories throughout this time, a temptation to move away, to deflect, if you will, from Russia's internal problems. What you also have is the development of a more articulate civil society in Russia, the development of a small but quite vocal middle class who want a greater role in things, and an urban working class who, by the end of the century, are becoming increasingly non-deferential. And these factors mean that not only do the Tsars have a more troublesome Russia to try to control, but some of their ministers are aware that the Tsars need to have a more nuanced, a more sophisticated, and a more involved relationship with the people than simply ruler and ruled. And foreign policy is a very good way to do this. It is a way of projecting might and power and traditional Russian Slavic Orthodox values overseas in defence of what the Russians see as the little guy, which in the case of this period of time are the Bulgarians, the Serbs. The Austrians also have a keen interest in the Balkans. Really, their interest is in stymieing Balkan nationalism. If you think that throughout the 19th century in Europe, we have kind of a pan-Germanism develop, which results really in Austria in 1866 being kicked out of the German Confederation, and a new North German Confederation emerging with simply Prussia as the dominant power, and this idea of the kleine Deutschland, the little Deutschland, the Germany without Austria involved, develops, and that's really what the nation state of Germany evolves into. Then you have a pan-Italianism evolved throughout the 20th century, which finds its final expression in the development of an Italian nation state in 1870. These two developments see Austria robbed of a lot of its influence, both in Germany and in the Italian states. And what Austria doesn't like the idea of is a pan-Slavism then developing in the Balkans, which will further erode Austria's sphere of influence in the Western Balkans, and also unleash other nationalisms within the Austrian Empire. The Austrian Empire is a multi-ethnic empire. It is it recognises a dual monarchy, the Austrian emperor and the kingdom of Hungary. And there are various other nationalities, Ruthenians, Poles, Czechs, Slovaks, Slovenes, Croats, Italians, and so on and so forth, within the Austrian Empire. And possibly the outbreak of nearby nationalist tensions would be too much and would perhaps send shockwaves through the Austrian Empire, fragmenting it into its tiny component parts, leaving the Austrians themselves as a very small Alpine people of no real importance, which is pretty much how Austria winds up at the end of the Second World War. So there are competing interests in the Balkans. Now, the Russians become involved in the Balkans in 1877, following the failed uprising of Bulgaria against the Ottomans. The Ottomans respond to the uprising with terrific violence and horrendous abuses, referred to by the Times newspaper as the Bulgarian atrocities or the Bulgarian outrages. The Times newspaper is really the only newspaper covering this, and the coverage of the fate of Bulgarian Christians at the hand of Turkish mercenaries called Bashi Bazooks scandalises London and America as well. Horrified, the chattering classes of London realise that the British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli is rather happy to support the Turks who are perpetrating these atrocities, as is Queen Victoria. The reason why is that the Turkish Empire, though weak, is worth propping up, because if it goes under, the Russians will be the beneficiaries. The Russians might be able to march further southwards and perhaps even establish themselves in the Mediterranean and threaten the Suez Canal. This, in turn, would threaten the route to India, Britain's vital trade lifeline. And so it's worth propping up one Oriental despotism against another, in Disraeli's eyes. Gladstone, the leader of the opposition, could not disagree more. He looked at as a devout Methodist Christian and somebody who professed not to have cynical ambitions in foreign policy, and yet when he comes to power after Disraeli, becomes involved in more foreign policy capers than any British Prime Minister of the 19th century, probably. He describes the attitude of Disraeli as outright cynicism.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And he says that we should not be supporting the Turks. We should, in fact, wage war on them if necessary in order to liberate the poor, oppressed Bulgarians. Well, no war is forthcoming from Britain. The policy of supporting supporting the Turks tacitly continues, and instead the Russians make war. The Russians march against the Turks, and for the first time in the 19th century, the Russians actually have a real result fighting Turkey. Most of the wars against the Turks in the 18th and 19th centuries are very inconclusive and muddled affairs where the Russians always manage to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory somehow. In this instance, in the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-88, the Russians actually come close to a long-standing goal of theirs, which is the capture of what they call Constantinople, but what everyone else refers to as Istanbul. Constantinople, of course, is the former capital of Byzantium, the wellspring of Eastern Christianity, or the Orthodox faith. And to many of the Orthodox czars of the 19th century, the capture of Constantinople was really the ultimate goal. And it is something that Nicholas II commits himself to during the First World War. And again, the Russians come reasonably close to achieving it, but not quite. Anyway, so the tensions between Austria and Russia are heightened when Russia forces the Turks to sign the Treaty of San Stefano. The Russians believed that very probably they would the Treaty of San Stefano would have to be revised anyway by an international conference. So they really go for as much as they can get, and they create a large Bulgarian state in the Balkans, which stretches all the way to the Adriatic and all the way to the Black Sea, and covers really probably about half of the entire size of the Balkans. So it's a huge state. And in that, they decide that Russia will have a kind of an overall supervising, guiding influence, and the big Bulgaria will be essentially a Russian satellite state in the Balkans. The British object to this because they know that this large new Bulgaria will have access to the sea. It'll be a conduit by which the Russians can get to the sea. They have been unable to use the Black Sea following the treaties at the end of the Crimean War without risking war with Britain. And now the use of Bulgaria is a kind of a way of getting back into the Black Sea and into the Adriatic and into the Mediterranean. So the British aren't happy, the British traditionally see the eastern end of the Mediterranean as their sphere of influence. The Austrians particularly are unhappy because they now see that the Russians have made a kind of a coup, if you will, to dominate all the Balkans, and they suspect the Russians will foment nationalist movements which will undermine them. It's worth mentioning here that from 1875 onwards, the League of Three Emperors, the Dreikaiserbund, between Germany, Austria and Russia existed. This was a treaty of friendship between the three nations, which essentially helped to isolate France and keep, as Bismarck saw it, Germany in a stable and safe position, not being surrounded by enemies, which is Bismarck's chief obsession, that Germany may become surrounded, may become encircled, and may have to fight a war on two fronts, which unfortunately for Germany unfolds in 1914. This obsession meant that having to try to reconcile Austria and Russia together became increasingly difficult. And what Bismarck realises in 1878... is that at a certain point, the interests of one power will have to come above the interests of another. Obviously, Bismarck doesn't particularly want the British to go to war with either side, because that would perhaps involve Germany in a European war. He particularly doesn't want the Austrians and the Russians to go to war. This is his chief interest. The proposition of a big Bulgaria is something that the British and the Austrians will not accept. Bismarck and his opposite number from Russia, Gorchakov, convince the delegation at the Berlin conference that there is a good reason for having a Bulgarian state in the Balkans that will help to stabilise the Balkans. But what Bismarck can't grant the Russians is the size of that state. So instead of a fairly modest Bulgaria is proposed, and the rest of the Balkan states are given effectively their independence. So you have now a situation whereby the Russians feel extremely hurt and cheated and resentful towards the Congress of Berlin. Not just to Germany, but to the rest of the Congress powers. and see this as a terrible insult. Russian public opinion back home is infuriated, and the Austrians are implicated really as being kind of the villain of the piece in the Russians' eyes. The Austrians have managed to gain a sphere of influence in the western half of the Balkans, particularly over Bosnia and Herzegovina. And Serbia also falls into the Austrian sphere of influence as a sort of, not as a direct colony, but as a state which really needs to pay more than lip service to Vienna. Austria has eyes on Salonika, and the Austrian Diet, in fact, actually criticises Andrássy, the Austrian foreign minister, for being too ambitious at the Congress of Vienna, for wanting too much, for acquiring too much, because many Austrian politicians suspect that the gains made at the Congress of Vienna, the Congress of Berlin, beg your pardon, are quite dangerous to Austria, might involve Austria in a war later on. This is where I base my argument that the Congress of Berlin is actually quite a dangerous and destabilising event in Europe. The Russians know full well that this is only a setback in their goal of dominating the Balkans. And there is a belief amongst the Russians that, irrespective of what the Congress says, war will be forthcoming between Austria and Russia at some point in the near future. The British, for their part, they also believe that war is now more likely after the Congress of Berlin than before it, because there is a realisation that by backing the Ottoman Empire, they've backed a state which is destined to continue its decline, to continue crumbling and to continue degrading. And there is a continued risk of instability. The new nations of the Balkans, Romania, Serbia and Bulgaria, all of whom see themselves as affiliated to Russia in one way or another due to their kind of Orthodox and Slavic ethnicities, they look, and particularly the Serbs, look to Russia and are actually quite critical of the Russians and say, well, why didn't you do more? We are now within the Austrian sphere of influence. We had wanted to be in yours, but you really should have actually done a bit more to project your power towards us to protect us from being, answerable to Austria. So the Congress of Berlin is an event is called by Bismarck to try to finally stabilise the Balkans, but it doesn't. What it does is it puts the problem of the Balkans off for a couple of decades. It doesn't resolve the crisis, it simply sets up one for the future. And this is really kind of part of the history of the Balkans in a way, in that the problem of the Balkans is very rarely very rarely resolved, and if so, only temporarily. It can be put off and yet re-emerges later on, and we see in the longer term one of the stabilising factors in the Balkans in the 20th century has been communism, and its decline at the end of the 20th century saw explosions of ethnic cleansing and ethnic violence. Anyway, I hope you find that interesting and useful, and if you are interested in this subject further, in the next week or two, my new ebook, International Relations 1870 to 1914, A Student's Guide, is going to be ready, and I will be letting you all know about that in the near future. Anyway, thanks very much, and thanks very much for everyone's support. We have hit the 25,000 listener mark as of yesterday. And so in the next week, I will be doing one of my famous and extravagant Explaining History giveaways. So stay tuned and I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.